Hello, everyone. Welcome to episode 11 of Christian History and Ideas with Dr. Nirmal Das and myself, John Coleman. Welcome, Dr. Das.
Great to be here, John. Thanks so much, and great to see you.
So we've—if we haven't hit the stratosphere, we've hit something. We hit the double digits, so here we are, and on to the triple digits. Now, we are going to talk today about trotting around the Mediterranean, I suppose. We started last month with Alexandria, and we're moving north a bit. We're going to Antioch. And we're going to talk about Antioch. We're going to talk about the culture of Antioch, very different than Alexandria. And then towards the end of this recording or the next, we're going to make connections to more recent events. And we'll see that there's nothing new under the sun. And many of the strains that the Church of Antioch was experiencing in the infancy of the church, they're still the same strains as we have now. Dr. Doc, where should we take off here? We do with the founding of the city itself, or was there a specific part?
Yeah, let's start with the beginning of things, and let's look at how the city was founded, what it was about, its reputation. Let's put the historical context in place, and then we can, you know, move around a bit more freely and in that context.
Excellent, excellent. So Antioch, this is Antioch on the Orontes, not to be confused with Pisidian Antioch, which is deeper in modern day Turkey, was founded by one of the generals of Alexander, Seleucus, and then a whole dynasty of guys called Antioch after him. And it ended up becoming the third most important city in the empire in terms of its population there. And before I go on, Dr. Doss, I'm getting a bit of feedback on the audio.
Yes, I'm getting a bit of that too, actually.
Okay, let's see here.
You're clearing up now if you come closer, I don't know.
Okay, better?
Yeah.
Maybe it's okay.
All right. Yeah, you're good now.
All right, very good. So this was the third largest city in terms of population, and unlike Rome and unlike Alexandria, Antioch was planned in a more systematic fashion. And so by the first century of the Christian era, you had these fantastic boulevards. Herod the Great, of the New Testament fame, he actually put a lot of building effort into these boulevards and things. So the city was a lot roomier than cities were in the ancient world, and it was, as cities are known for, a hub of people coming and going. And indeed, and this brings us to our immediate topic, when the persecutions in Jerusalem really began kicking off, and you have that event in those early days with St. Paul coming up to round up the believers, many Christians from Jerusalem themselves came and settled in Antioch. And with that, we have the mention of that is the city where Christians first got their name in Antioch.
Yeah, that's great. So let me just fill in a few things here into that, great summary you've given. Now, let me start with the last point you made about the Christians being called Christians in Antioch. This is interesting because Antiochans in the Hellenistic world at this time had a great reputation for being witty and being sarcastic and being all of this sort of thing where they would make up. And also they were famous for coming up with really nasty nicknames. So when they came up with a for the believers of Jesus as Christians, what they were doing was playing into this reputation that they had in the ancient world of being these inventors of nicknames. And there's other inventions of nicknames. For example, the Emperor Julian in the Apostate, you know, they called him the goat because of his beard. And there were all kinds of jokes about him being goatish and goaty and all that, you know. So it's quite interesting. So they had a very strong reputation for being this kind of a personality as a city. So it's not surprising that it's in this city, of all the cities, that Christians are given a nickname. And it is a nickname, and it's also a derogatory term, we shouldn't forget. Because the Christians really does mean in Latin, you know, little Christs, you know. So they're like little Jesuses, that's what they're pretending to be. So it was a sarcastic remark. And when, you know, this is mentioned in Acts, I think the people would have got it. Oh, the Antiochians did this, did they? I think there was an understanding of what this was all about. So they were quite scurrilous in their humor or their wit, which is interesting. So there's a character about them that comes across. The other thing that we should mention is that Antioch was very closely settled, or very closely located, I should say, to a very famous temple of Apollo, the temple of Daphne. And this was just a little south of the city. And the temple of Daphne, and Daphne in Greek means, of course, laurel, and we know the myth of Daphne and all that. So the interesting thing is that this location, and there were gardens here around the temple, and these gardens were known as the pleasure gardens of Daphne, and they had all kinds of, you know, nefarious associations of, you know, people going there for all kinds of pleasures. Therefore, in the ancient world, there was this very famous phrase used about Antioch, in that the inhabitants of Antioch followed the Daphniki mores, you know, the morality of the of Daphnians, or, you know, the morality associated with the pleasure gardens. So it had a very a twofold reputation, scurrilous wit and pleasure loving, and, you know, all kinds of you know, all kinds of pleasures could be had in this garden. And it had a very, very strong reputation during this time. The other thing I should mention, and you mentioned this very as well, I just want to elaborate. This was also one of the richest, the third richest city in the Roman world, after Rome and Alexandria. And because of that, because of the trade routes, you know, the route and all that sort of thing from the east, because of that, it was known as, I think, Queen of the East, Antioch the Great, Antioch the Beautiful, those kinds of names, because it was a very beautiful city, architecturally and so forth. As you mentioned, it's the third largest, and the population, it's a controversial thing among scholars, but the population is estimated anywhere from 200,000 to 800,000. So it's a huge, huge city. And why we have this discrepancy is because there are various, you know, accounts that give us these figures, and, you know, we have to just try to figure out, put them together. Very quickly, the city was destroyed in 540 AD by the Persians, and it never really recovered after that. It went down the tubes and became like a backwater, and it never really became, you know, what it was. Justinian tried to recover it, recoup it, and try to rebuild it, but it didn't work. And finally, I think during the First Crusade, about 1098, it was conquered by the Crusaders in 1098, and they held it, I think, until about 1268, when, you know, the Turks, and, well, actually not the Turks, the Sultans of Egypt captured it, and they held it until 1516, at which time, you know, all of Turkey went into the hands of the Turks, the Ottomans. So that's the Ottoman conquests, and so forth. So modern day Antioch is known as Antakya in Turkey today. And it's a small city, and it's a poor city, and all that sort of thing. So it's not really what it was. But you know, there's, we can talk about this a little later, but there are some really interesting archaeological discoveries that were made in the 1930s, which have really given it a lot of what we understand it to be. So what we're talking about really does come from these archaeological discoveries made in the 1930s.
Well, by the grace of the British cartographers after World War I, Antioch, in my preparation for this recording, just is across the Syrian border in Turkey, as Dr. Das said, and it's only 60 miles from us. Could have easily been plowed under.
Exactly. It could easily have been plowed under. Yeah, that's right.
I get the feeling that Antioch indeed has a different personality than Alexandria, maybe a little bit less highbrow, a little bit more workaday, with comments on the ribald humor of the wits there.
Exactly. Yes, it has less of a intellectual feel to it, or you know, it has less concern with head in the sky approach to understanding things. It's more practical, and here it's I think it's more Roman in than anything else. The other cities like Alexandria and others are Hellenistic to the core. They're very Greek, i.e. they love to argue about all kinds of minute details and things until the cows come home. Whereas the Antiochans are more hard-headed. They're more practical, we might say. And they're more interested in the here and now, in the day-to-day things, as opposed to something vast. And this comes across in their theology, which will be, later we can look at, that they develop and what they do. So yes, they have this reputation of being scurrilous, pleasure-loving, and also highly practical. In that, I think they're very much part of this Roman approach to the Roman worldview, Roman mindset, which is very practical as opposed to the Hellenistic or the Greek mind, which is very, very esoteric, for lack of a better term.
And we can definitely turn to the intellectual battles and the battles over the Mosaic law and things, but just riffing on that concept of Antioch being more down to earth or more workaday, maybe we can discuss, Dr. Das, the role of Antioch organizationally, hierarchically, as well as a missionary center, because we do start seeing, even in the second century, this demarcation of the clergy, deacon, presbyter, bishop, and we see that development from the apostolic church itself.
Yes, I think that would be good to, but let's put that in context as well very quickly within Christian history. As we've discussed, Antioch has a very important role to play in the early church. Why that is because, for several reasons. One, it's the location of the first Gentile church. So you have this breaking away from the Jewish traditions, which was, the problem and the challenge of the early Christians of how to manage the Jewish tradition, it was also the center, the command center of St. Paul's missionary work. All his three missionary journeys began from Antioch, so it's a very important center for that, and therefore I think it's proper that we might also refer to it as the mother city of the churches of both Asia Minor and Europe, because it's from here that the missionary activities, both East and West, spread out. So it really is, in a very interesting way, the birthplace of foreign missions, of foreign Christian missions, I should say. I think Acts 13:2 talks about this very briefly. And as the Christians were called Christians here, but the interesting thing as well among the Christians in Antioch was, as I mentioned, how to manage the Hebrew tradition or the Jewish tradition. And here you have that big controversy controversy of the question, should Gentiles be circumcised? And this was a huge problem in the very early church, because you had one group all located in Jerusalem that said, yep, you have to. And Antioch was saying, well, hang on a minute, maybe not, because then we have to become Jewish first and then we become Christians, or can we just jump right into Christianity and bypass the Jewish traditions and customs? And this has become, as we know in Acts, a huge problem. And this battle is happening in Antioch. So Antioch is at the forefront of this distinction, or rather, I think it might even be better to say that it's at the forefront of defining what Christianity is going to be culturally, intellectually, even emotionally, and all those things. You know, faith aside, it's deciding what the mindset, the Christian mindset, is going to be. I think that's a very important thing to keep in mind, because now the Christians are saying, are we really Jewish? Are we that old tradition? Or has something else happened to us which will take us beyond this tradition into another mindset, into another culture, into another way of life? So I think that is very important. The other thing I should mention is that St. Peter, of course, is also placed here. He comes here, I think this is when Paul rebukes him, saying, hey, hang on, how come you come, we'll show up and pretend to be a Jew and don't eat with us and all that sort of thing. So there's that struggle going on again. And this, of course, also legitimizes the Orthodox tradition of the papacy, of their popes, saying that it started here, et cetera, et cetera. And there are some indications, some theologians think, that even St. Luke was born here. The entire gospel cycle, in a way, is associated with the city. So it has a very prominent role to play in this, in this regard. What else? Very quickly, I don't want to, keep going on about it. Very quickly, there's the bishop, the various famous bishops, the three I can think of is Ignatius, the very famous bishop, and he's the first Antiochian martyr, martyred in 115 AD. And this was, Antioch had suffered a catastrophic earthquake, and the citizens at the time blamed the Christians. And the guy that they hauled up to on the carpet was their bishop, Ignatius. After a brief trial, condemned him to death, sent him off to Rome, where he was torn apart by, creatures and beasts, lions probably, in the Flavian Colosseum, and this is 115 AD. But his bones were brought back into the church, and there's 20 very famous churches in Antioch that have been discovered, and more probably are around. We need to discover them. And of course, Ignatius wrote the very famous seven letters, which are very important documents for post-apostolic Christianity, i.e., once the apostles, the immediate 12, die, the generation that comes after them is recorded, is one of the recordings of that generation is Ignatius. And there's Theophilus as well, and prominent theologians like Serapion, Theodoret, Theodore. These are very important people in church history. So Antioch is producing, aside from its reputation, it is also producing some very solid theologians at this time, and they are having a great effect on what's going to happen next in Christianity.
Indeed, our friend from the last episode, Origen, he also at one point, by invitation of a wealthy woman, was invited during one of his exiles from Alexandria to teach up in Antioch, to teach her and I believe he was given a guard even to take him up there, because we spoke about the contentious theological topic. Can we amplify that topic of the law and the application For people who may not be familiar with it, it's always delightful to go through the New Testament with young students and high schoolers, and they're usually surprised about the prominence of that topic of the diets and so forth.
Right.
And it runs up right against really the cultural aspect you bring up, Doctor, and also the trend one sees throughout all the scriptures of the sublimation of the extension of this idea of revelation and the sublimation of virtue just being an external thing to being most purely, well, certainly having an external expression, but also being an internal perfection and so forth. And that's really what clashes in Antioch, that topic there. So maybe we can elaborate just briefly on that for people who may not perceive the profundity of that argument.
Sure, yes. So, you know, getting back down to, you know, the essentials, what's happening here is that there's this great struggle. First, the historical context is great struggle of this new faith in Jesus as the Messiah. And then either the acceptance of that concept and the rejection of it is the primary struggle that is defining all this. And within this struggle emerges, of course, those who believe Jesus is the Messiah, the Jewish Messiah. And for them, Jesus becomes the fulfillment of what is a Jew all about, i.e. the definition of what a Jew is. And through this definition then, life can be ordered, lived, and so forth, and all the structures fall into place. With what happens with St. Paul is because of his own, approach to this division of Judaism and Christianity, the two things that are now part of this larger structure. Because let's not forget, during the time of the Church of Jerusalem, Christianity is part and parcel, a version of Judaism, of the Hebrew faith, or however you want to call it. But here, I think from now on, we can be properly using the word Jew and Judaism. And what is happening is that since there are so many different kinds of radically different kinds of Hebrew faith, which we looked at briefly in other discussions, for example, there's 13 different kinds of what we might call Jews during the time of Jesus, so much so that, you know, historically we don't really know what kind of a Jew Jesus was, to which of these factions he belonged. We're not really sure. So there's all this different turmoil of these factions, and of course Paul comes out of this factionalism, very strong and intense factionalism, and what he's now trying to do is to resolve that factionalism by a different approach completely, saying enough of this, you know, what is the essential thing we believe? And that is what we need to do, because if we get into this mode of what to eat and circumcise or not, and what to wear and who to eat with and all that sort of thing, we're gonna have some serious problems here, because we're gonna fall back into that factionalism. And this is gonna be the struggle for Paul right through, right? He's going to be facing this factionalism and trying to battle it, sometimes losing, sometimes winning. And, you know, it's going to be hounding him to the very end. And he doesn't want this for the new faith. He doesn't want this factionalism. So inherent in that division of Jew and Christian now is this factionalism. And that mindset by those that have come from Jerusalem into Antioch is also, the mindset is also imported into Antioch at this time, which is, who is a Christian? What is a Christian? That those two essential questions. And of course, the immediate point of reference for this question is the Hebrew tradition. So you have to be this and that, and then you can believe Jesus is a Messiah. If you cannot do any of this, well then, sorry, Jesus is not a Messiah for you, because you haven't done any of this stuff. You're still a pagan. So then the next question is, once this factionalism is resolved, the next question is the definition of what a Christian is. And then the third problem is, does this message go out to non-Jews? Or is it just for us? And this question is going to be the bigger problem in Antioch discussed. But all of this is funneling into that bigger question. And then the missionary work and all this sort of thing. So this is a very, you know, I don't want to get into the nitty-gritty too much because there's no point of it. But the point, the real essential thing is that through this three-step process of definition of what a Christian is and what kind of significance the Hebrew tradition should have for the new identity or in the new identity, within this context is going to emerge the identity of what a Christian is, what belief in Jesus is all about, especially for people who are not Jews, ethnically or whatever. So it's a very interesting question, but it gets resolved and fought over at this time. And here we need to just remind ourselves, we talked about it briefly again previously, within the Hebrew faith at a little bit earlier and at this time is a very essential division and a very problematic division for them, which is one of Hellenistic Jews and the Jerusalemite Jews. And these two Jews do not like each other. They're always fighting, they're always having a problem with each other and all this sort of thing. They don't get along. So that's the larger context. So when you start talking about Gentiles coming into the Hebrew faith, you're going to start that problem again of that Jerusalemite Hellenistic Hebrews faith that is always been at contention. So it's a very complex issue, but I think it's going to be very ably resolved by the efforts of Paul. And it all happens in the city as well. So that's, you know, something we need to, you know, keep in mind as we go further.
And before we get into perhaps the various heresies, the Gnostics, the Nicolaitans, and the Docetists and things that pop up and whatnot, I think it's important to consider a point, a very profound point that you brought up a few months ago, and that is, Nirmal, the idea that a very popular misunderstanding that Judaism was this codified thing before Christianity, and then there was a break. And as we approach, even, you know, maybe we can look at the structure just organizationally in Antioch of the church, maybe some comments would be appropriate just to remind yourself and myself and the viewers about the amorphous nature of Hebrew belief at this time. It's not this codified existing thing.
It isn't codified at all, actually. And this is something, it's a great point you brought up, because often there's, as you rightly point out, a lot of confusion. And often we see, and this happens not just with Judaism, but it happens with all religions, quote unquote. Even the word religion is the wrong thing to use in this context. Religion makes no sense out of Christianity, out of the Christian context. But that's a different topic we can talk about another day. But within this problem of what is Judaism or what is the Hebrew faith of this time, and notice this is why I said we have to be careful about these terms, even when we project backwards from, once we get into the BC era, you know, we have a problem with what Judaism is or what the Hebrew faith is. Often people think the Judaism as yet they see it in our day and age is somehow the older roots of Christianity, which is not the case at all. And here we have to be very, very specific in our discussion, because what we're really talking about when we talk about contemporary modern day Judaism, as we see when we go out, the synagogues and all that sort of thing, that is a medieval faith system that comes into being around the 11th centuries. It has very little to do with what the faith system was of the Second Temple Judaism as it's known, i.e. the Hebrew faith that was...
I think we lost Dr. Das. He'll be back momentarily.
It was around when Jesus' important thing happened. One is that, first of all, is that there were various rebellions against the Romans by the Jews. Again, not by all the Jews. And this is, we have to be very, actually the majority of the Jews were peaceful. They had no problem with the Romans. So the movie version of the Jews always upset at the Romans is you know, a movie version. And what the problem is that there was a lot of criminality. The criminal elements in Judea made it worse for everybody, i.e. the criminality extended to such an extent that the Romans had to step in and do something. And secondly, this criminality, of course, was in the countryside and all this sort of thing. So it was widespread. The second problem was that there was this ongoing issue of one faction somehow becoming the voice of the entire Jewish people. And this the Romans recognized, because they had friends among the Jews whom they knew and understood and who got along fine with them. But there was a few factions that did not want the Jews there, and they made it worse for everybody else. This is how it was looked at. And this worse scenario, of course, became intolerable until finally, the authority, the Jewish authorities at the time, did resort to the Romans for help. And when that happened, of course, the factions declared an all-out war, and that led to the destruction of the Second Temple. So you had the first destruction, the Babylonians and the exile and all that sort of thing. That's the first temple period. And the second temple, when the Jews come back and rebuild, and then it's destroyed, the second temple is destroyed by the Romans, and there is no third temple, right? This is the end of Judaism, as we understand it, the Hebrew faith, within the context of the Old Testament. So the Old Testament disappears, and now the Romans are very thorough. They're systematic in getting rid of this problem area. They don't disappear, you know. They don't, deny the faith. What they do is that they resettle all the Jews throughout their empire. This is known as the diaspora, the Jewish diaspora. I.e., there are Jews in all parts of the Roman world, and they're not concentrated in one place. So they're not going to be a very effective problem for the Romans. Secondly, they occupy Jerusalem, change its name forever. Jerusalem is given a name until only recently, by the way. It's a 19th century renaming of the place. And before that, it was named various things by the Romans. And so for almost 2,000 years, it was not known as Jerusalem. It was something else. So the Romans very systematically get rid of the hot spots. So there's no congregating into a holy city. It's no longer a holy city. It's either, it's only St. Helena later on, the mother of Constantine, who goes and invents this concept of the Holy Land. This is a Christian invention. But anyway, the Romans are very thorough in this destruction. They undo all the power structures of the Judaic systems, and then they dissipate this power structure throughout their empire, so there's not concentrated. And lastly, they declare that the Jews cannot really practice their faith in concentrated ways, i.e. you can't have huge temples, you can't have huge synagogues and so forth. And it's only much later, I forget the date, I think 4th or 5th, maybe even the 6th century, I think 600-700 AD, I'm not sure. It's only then that the Romans finally give the Jews permission to recongregate, i.e. to come together as a group in various locales and localities. It's then that modern Judaism begins. And in order to begin, what they do is they latch on to one aspect of Judaism that they're familiar with, through the Old Testament and the New Testament, which is the rabbinical Judaism, which is what we see today. So what we have today is a construct that happens in the early Middle Ages. And this construct is, well, let's be Jews. How are we going to be Jews? we can be Jews this way, i.e. we become rabbinical. And this is why, for example, people often ask, why don't the Jews still do animal sacrifices and all that sort of thing? Well, because they're not that Judaism anymore. This is a medieval faith created consciously, and some people think as a reaction to Christianity. That's a very interesting vein we can go down into some other time. The anti-Christian mode of contemporary Judaism, and this becomes then the focus of the faith. But the important thing to note is that in the first century, when we're going back again, just to summarize, in the first century, there is no monolithic entity known as Judaism. So whenever you have people talking about Judaism during the time of Christ or Judaism in the first century, you know these people don't know what they're talking about, because there is no such thing. There is no monolithic faith structure that can be identified as the Judaic faith that was practiced by everybody in that area. And this, by the way, applies to all ancient religions, that so-called religions that we point to. They're all, in a way, reactions to Christianity and inventions because of Christianity. And by this I mean Hinduism, Buddhism, and so forth. All these so-called ancient religions are in themselves not ancient. Most of them are 18th, 19th centuries inventions. So here we have to be very, very careful in our analysis, and that's a great point you brought up. We have to be very careful in our analysis, so we don't, create fake news about the past, because that is what ends up happening. Because if once you just start doing that, then you can impose all kinds of your own views that are really trendy in 2020, but have nothing to do with the first century or centuries earlier than that.
And that history you mentioned with the Romans in Judea, it ends up, in a sense, it almost reminds me of the tensions in much later history of Gallicanism in France.
Yes, very much.
The French Revolution kind of solves that problem, and it's not a problem after largely because the Gallicans are dead or they sold out, and all you have left are the Romans, we'll say, with that Romanitas. And it's similar, I think, because you mentioned, the famous war in 70 with Titus, but also in preparation for this, the Bar Kokhba's revolt in 135 or whatever led to a lot of Hebrews coming into Antioch too.
Yes, there was a huge exodus.
And this, it in a sense solved that problem. So a good point to bring up there with that, Dr. Das. But beyond just the tension with the Judaizers of the early church, there is something, it's never mentioned by name in the New Testament, but certainly in the epistles of St. John, and certainly in the history of the Antiochian church, the rise of actually something far more dangerous, and that's Gnosticism. And what is the role of what is Gnosticism? Maybe we can define that first, and then how does it differ from Orthodox Christianity? And what is the role of the hierarchy and whatnot in Antioch of defining what is the faith in these early years?
Yes, so why don't we contextualize Gnosticism first, and then we can proceed to the hierarchy of the early church at this time in this place. So let's look at Gnosticism particularly, and then proceed further. So when we're referring to Gnosticism, again, like with Judaism, we're not talking about a monolithic concept. This is the problem with a lot of modern day analysis. People like to think that once you've defined one term, you can just, plunk it down on a whole bunch of people and they say, oh, he's a Gnostic.
But I have my Gnostic Bible. What?
Yes, of course. Yes, the book codifies everything. So Gnosticism at this time, which is a convenient term, by the way, because there's all kinds of them and all kinds of different approaches. And by the way, this is going to have a very crucial role to play once we get to it eventually in the development of Islam that messianic tradition. But anyway, that's a footnote. Gnosticism at this time, let's contextualize it. Once Christianity emerges into the Hellenistic world and becomes, a role player, it's no longer just a little thing in Jerusalem, becomes something important, i.e. lots of people are becoming Christians. Larry Hurtado did an excellent book, I think I pointed out earlier, Why Would Anyone Want to Become Christian or something? I forget the exact title, it's a great title. But in it, and of course there's other studies, the point was that in the first century, people are becoming Christians at lightning speed. I mean, this is spreading really fast throughout the Roman Empire. So you have Christians from the borders of Scotland to all the way to Syria. And that's a huge spread. And of course, beyond into the Persian Empire and all that sort of thing. So Christianity is a huge, huge movement throughout the Roman world. And the Romans are not, of course, unaware of it. But as the faith is moving through all this territory, in this geography, of course, it is encountering the older philosophical traditions that have existed here. And these philosophical traditions, of course, clash with the basic worldview of the Christians. And the basic worldview, of course, is one of neglecting the world in order to, achieve the next one. This is the summary of what Christians are doing. And this creates a problem, a philosophical problem at this time in the first and the second and the third, well into the fifth century AD. And this problem is we can, simplify it and look at it in a very particular way. And it's this. This problem is that if we're supposed to be neglectful of this life live contra mundum, that famous phrase, live against the world, then how is life to be itself managed? Do we get married? Do we have children? Does the world perpetuate it? How do we perpetuate the world? And there are some factions and some Gnostical traditions that will say, don't get married, don't have children, the world is evil, and all this sort of thing. And one of these very important critiques of Christianity is through Platonism, forms of Plato's philosophy that looks at the world in a very coherent manner, i.e. the world as harmony. This is, I won't go into Plato, but the world as harmony is the essential core understanding of how the world works. And here we can, elaborate on all these various different things. But for the Christian, this is a problem. If the world is harmonious, then the role of faith is a very questionable one. And why? Well, because then the role of salvation is a very questionable one. Because if everything is a unitary and harmonious, then that means that there is no real need for Jesus to come and save us and take us to heaven and all this sort of thing, because everything is harmonious. What do you mean? You need to be saved from the harmony, which is, the system that's working perfectly already. Why would you need to be saved from it? And if it's working perfectly already, why do you want to live against it? Because then you're becoming chaotic. And this is a very important Roman critique of the Christians from their worldview. They're elements of chaos. They're agents of chaos. And we have to control them, therefore. And why are they considered that? Well, because of this philosophical worldview. It's a very coherent Hellenistic worldview, which says the world is harmonious, i.e. there's nothing in it that is going to be, there are certain elements, but we have to keep that harmony going. Christians come along and say, well, wait a minute, this is not how it is. So it's from this clash, I won't go in too much into it, but it's from this clash of the Platonic worldview, the harmonious worldview, and the Christian worldview based on salvation and the fallen human being, not harmonious, then that clash creates certain kinds of compromises within the Hellenistic and the Christian mindset. And this, within this area, gray area of compromise, comes Gnosticism. This is where Gnosticism emerges. And then now we can get into the particulars of what this compromise is going to be doing. And one of the most important ones is trying to define what the Platonists have never done, trying to define what is evil. What do we mean by that which is evil? For the Platonists, it's very easy. Anything that's not harmonious, right? Anything anti-harmony is evil. Got it. For the Christians, it's not so cut and dried, because for the Christian, evil is associated with a certain kind of energy or force within creation, i.e. the devil or Satan. And it's this force or energy that has to be reckoned with. And because it has to be reckoned with in the world, hence the creation of rejection of the world, the contra mundum scenario, and so forth, where the world is not perfect yet because it's fallen, i.e. so the world is not harmonious, as the Platonists say. It's chaotic. And the only thing way we can have order in this world is through the salvific process of Christ, and so forth. So
I think, Dr. Das, that would be a good place to leave it for this particular episode.
Great.
And viewers, absolutely stay tuned for episode 12, where we're going to pick this right up and bring up some of these topics to nowadays, because these same topics and these same debates are still happening that we saw in Antioch. And we like reinventing the wheel, I think, oftentimes. So stay tuned for episode 12 of Christian History and Ideas. Before we sign off here, Dr. Das, tell us what we can look at in the Postol for this month of August.
Actually, we've got some really great articles right now in the Postol. I think last time I mentioned this is an edition or an issue dedicated to Sir Roger Scruton, and there's a lot of work about a lot of essays and articles about him and about his very important work as one of the foremost conservative philosophers of our time. And there's also a very, very important and interesting article on education by a friend of ours that we all know by the name of John Coleman. Very good article, excellent article. I would encourage people to read it. Also some really interesting articles on what is going on today, pulling down of statues, the canceling of history, the cancel culture, and all that sort of thing. So I would suggest that people have go over and take a look. And please do join our mailing list. It's very important that we become community conscious and not be atomized into individualized kind of worlds that we live in. We shouldn't internalize everything. Let's become a community. So please join the mailing list.
There are websites besides Facebook and YouTube out there, and the Postol is one of them. For my part, I run a college here in New Milford, Connecticut, a little plucky affair. Apocrystal Stasis, and the only announcement I would have would be that separate from this show, I do a podcast during the school year, and this coming year, we're going to look at the major schools of historiography. We're going to look at the Whig school and the Marxist school and the feminist school and all the school and so forth. So if you're interested in that, you go over to apocrystastasisinstitute.wordpress.com. Also, if you want to get in touch with Dr. Das or myself, maybe you have a question or a comment, you can put that in the description of this video on BitChute and YouTube, as well as writing us at christianhistoryandideas@gmail.com. And we're very open to show suggestions and hints and tips and things like that. So with that, Dr. Das, thank you for your expertise and helping to learn about ancient Antioch, ancient Christian Antioch.